everybody, it's Paul Yeager, and this is the MTOM Show podcast, a production of Market to Market and Iowa PBS. One of the long-standing traditions of Market to Market is the market analysis segment, and we pride ourselves on a variety of analysts to give you perspective on what's happening in the grain markets. You've come to know many over the years, maybe some are new, and today we are going to bring in a new voice to just give you something else to think about. You know, you watch the show, but now here is somebody different. Sean O'Leary has started a company in Iowa, in ag country, called Hawkeye Commodity Brokers. He's not a Cyclone, but he is a Hawkeye. We'll talk about the difference there and how he made his start, how his dad used to talk to him about the business and his eyes would roll back in the back of his head. Funny how life sometimes goes. That's our discussion today. If you have any feedback for me, it's paul.yeager@iowapbs.org. I always look forward to hearing from you. If you feel like a comment, those are kind of fun too. Sean, how does a guy in agriculture feel he's strong enough to make Hawkeye the first part of his company name? Doesn't that get you in trouble in Cyclone Country?
It does, especially this year. I've been kind of quiet this year, rightfully so, with all due respect to another fine school, is kind of how I put it. I think we're very fortunate to have two very fine schools. You know, I went to Iowa, but had all kinds of friends that went to Iowa State. So I knew I was potentially getting into it when I named the company the way I did. But it's a Cyclone state this year. It's been a Hawkeye state. It's two great schools in one great state, though.
You grew up in the shadow of Cyclone Country. Carroll is not that far from Ames. You share Highway 30 right there. You mentioned a lot of friends that went there. What went into your decisions between schools? I have no idea if you were looking at maybe a small school and decided on Iowa instead.
Yeah, I jokingly say that Iowa City was further away from home, and at the time they had a better football team. That's kind of how I thought as a high school senior, unfortunately. But it is what it is. I also had, truthfully, I had two older sisters that attended the University of Iowa, graduated from there. So okay, we had a little bit of a pedigree going at that school at that time.
And you weren't studying agriculture at the time either. You went for a different major.
I did. I was an open major to start, went into broadcasting and film, which you'll appreciate, I'm sure. So, you know, I got to school, didn't really know what I wanted to do. Went into that field, moved back home to Carroll while I was looking for a job. And I said to my dad, he asked me, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I'm open to a lot of things, but I want to work for a good-sized company that's at the head of their field. And he said, well, the company I work for is at the head of their field. Dad, I didn't know that. You know, he had spent years while I was in grade school and high school trying to explain to me what it was he did. And it always made my eyes roll to the back of my head. I had no idea what he was talking about. Started with him, and the company was Lynn Waldock, and they were eventually sold in 2000, but they were the first and eventually the largest discount brokerage in the country. And I fell in love with it from day one, and very intriguing industry to be in, always challenging.
Well, you have to fill me in. What exactly is a discount brokerage? What's that mean?
Well, at the time, that was in, you know, 89 and 90 when I started, that's when everything was traded open outcry in the pit. So nothing done electronically. And of course, discount today means something entirely different. But we had customers that all they wanted was execution. They knew what they wanted to do. They just needed someone to do it for them. Where Lynn Waldock really had an in was they were the first to transmit orders electronically from a trade desk like ours in Carroll, Iowa, to just outside the pit. The order was brought in by a runner, executed by a broker, reported electronically back. So they were night and day different in the way of execution. So they got things done quickly and they did them well. And it was a great company to work for. Great company.
Ted Seifert talks about his time working on the floor as a runner, as an intern, and he would be one of those runners of the trades. Did you ever aspire to go into Chicago and work on the floor?
I did. And I actually was kind of invited to do so. But at the time, I had two small kids living in Carroll. And I saw it as kind of a daunting thing, someone in my position. And I kind of, I jokingly said the whole time I was in Carroll that, you know, I like Carroll a lot. And it's especially nice when you can make Chicago money and not live in Chicago. So I kind of fell back on that for a long, long time. Yeah.
Well, there's something about the Chicago way and the rural way of, you know, Carroll is a town, but it still is not a suburb of Chicago. It is different.
Exactly.
But you're still involved with the commodities, the communication side. Do you feel like that was a major that, how did that help you? I won't say wasted because I'm a communications major, so I can't say, Mom, that my major was wasted, but how is it that that has helped you do what you do now?
Yeah, well, it's all about communication. You don't, in a lot of ways, I kind of feel like I came into the industry and into finance with kind of a blank slate, which can be an advantage. I didn't have anything ingrained in me that was going to potentially be problematic. And when it comes to opening accounts at that time, we were opening accounts for, you know, we had all kinds of customers. Anybody that was successful in their field and could afford to open an account to trade futures and options, they came to us. So we had farmers, we had grain and livestock producers, obviously, but we had doctors, dentists, attorneys, real estate people, hotel, restaurant owners, you name it. And the communication side of it really came into play there. I think if you have good oral and written communication skills, you can go a long ways, whether you're in the finance side or any other industry. So I think it paid off in that regard.
Because in a way you have to explain what is a complex philosophy of buying something in the future that you don't physically own for a delivery that you won't take, but I might take, to not scare the bejesus out of somebody.
Yeah, yeah. And my dad was a very patient person when he tried to explain all that to me when I first started.
Except you said you rolled your eyes in the back of your head. So he needed to put it, because that whole explain it to me like I'm a fourth or a fifth grader. Father and son is different than a customer.
It took months, maybe years. Yeah, yeah. And then maybe it's easier when it's not a father and son, right? But yeah, it's What I like about the futures and options side of it, the futures are, you can eventually kind of explain that to anyone. You're selling something you don't own, but it's a promise to buy it back. And if you don't do so, this happens and you want to avoid that. But it's the options side of it that really interests me. And I think producers could really do themselves a lot of good by educating themselves or becoming educated about what's possible on the option side of it. Because if you start with futures and then throw in long puts and or long calls, you've scratched 5% of the surface, honestly. There is a world of opportunities in between those two two categories. So, and I tell people when I make trade recommendations to both spec and hedge customers, I said, you know, the only way to really learn how to do it is to actually do it. And you can, it's kind of like a measurement of an inch. Is it exactly an inch, or is it just over or just under? And you can keep slicing and adding zeros after that decimal. You can do the same with the option market as well.
When your father in his company, I'll ask in a moment about how the customer has changed, but let's button up how you got involved with what your dad was doing and then transfer it into your own operation.
Right. Well, the discount side of it, eventually towards the end of the 90s, early 2000, some people will remember, others won't, but it was kind of a race between the CME and the CBOT as far as which electronic platform would win out. The Board of Trades was initially called Project X or Project A. The CME had their own matching system and they called it Globex. Well, we all know which of those two won out. And the CME basically, they kind of incorporated the Board of Trade over time. So at the end of, starting in the early 2000s is when everything became more and more electronic. Lynn Waldock was sold to Refco. Some will remember Refco out of Sioux City, Iowa. They filed for bankruptcy in 2005. They cooked the books on an IPO. So Lynn Waldock, a great company to work for, got sold to, as someone put it, the dirtiest firm on the street. And we found out a handful of years later that was indeed the case. So we went from being a branch of Lynn Waldock to a branch of Refco. Refco was bought by a firm eventually known as MF Global. MF Global filed for bankruptcy in 2011, and that at the time was one of the top 10 bankruptcies in the U.S. And there were those weren't pleasant times, let me put it that way. But after MF Global filed for bankruptcy, we went over to RJ O'Brien as our clearing member. We became an introducing broker at that time, no longer just a branch office of a large corporation. So we've been incorporated as Hawkeye Commodity Brokers since 2011.
And was your dad done at that time working?
Dad passed away at age 72 in, I think, 2006. So he had stepped out of the business. It was my brother Mark and I and another order entry clerk. And that was the case until we moved into home offices in 2016. My wife and I moved to Des Moines in 2019. We've got two adult sons here in the metro. I've got a daughter that's a pharmacist in Iowa City, and our youngest is a daughter works in TV production in Dallas, Texas. So we enjoy where we are now.
She's going to critique this interview, isn't she, if I didn't get the lighting right on you?
You know, even if this interview didn't take place, she'd be critiquing me.
But I didn't hear a next generation involved in what you're doing.
They are not. The older son is a contractor. The other works for a friend here in town in manufacturing, and the daughters are Iowa City and Dallas. I think they're smart enough to not go into this business.
Well, okay. You mentioned you're in the home. Does that make it easier to get up at 3 a.m. to start reading through the overnights?
Interesting you should say that, because you had someone on the other day that I you asked him about I don't recall who it was, doesn't really matter, but 3 a.m. came up in the conversation, and I thought, you know, I remember when all that started, and we'd have customers complain, you know, our especially grain customers, they'd say, you know, I don't like this overnight trade, you know, it just, it doesn't sit well with me. And, you know, I would explain that the market's going to be open and moving somewhere when it's not here. It's not going to just wait around. And you'll remember during open outcry and prior to that night trade coming about, you'd have gap open moves at 9:30 Central time, and people would just get their bell rung, you know. And you can get your bell rung a different way now. But going back to the options side of it, and how you can take control of the markets, I tell people, when you learn how to use the options, and again, not just buying puts and buying calls, that's just the start of it. When you can learn how to use the option market to protect a different position, including a futures position, you can go to bed at night and know that you're not going to get your bell rung. You know, you might be limiting yourself in potential profit, but I think there's a trade-off. You know, if you don't sleep well, you're not going to work well the next day.
Well, and that's, you know, I was going to ask, we'll come back to how the customer has changed. Now the customer can get updates from whomever, whenever, about any movement during the course of the day or at night. So what you're saying is, if you take a little bit of work, spend a little bit of money to find a position and create a safe spot for you, a strike or a sell point, sleep is a little easier to have than, but producers, I'm guessing some of your customers have had some very sleepless nights. How do you talk them back from, hey, help me out, let me help you here?
Well, there's and there is only so much you can do, and obviously there's a distinction between a hedger and a speculator. You know, the hedger has skin in the game. The hedger, unless he's completely hedged, is going to have a blow softened by the fact that he's got inventory that is not yet priced. So that's one way to look at it. But honestly, there's only so much you can do when you're talking about long or short futures going into a night session. You're just kind of at the mercy of what's going to happen globally and how money chases money. And that game never sleeps.
Perfect transition to the wheat market. What do you see in 2023 with the global money and the global story? Because wheat has become an absolute global commodity because it's grown in so many places. But when you have major global stories impacting the one side of the ledger, how do you see wheat in 23?
Well, going into it and looking at the past just few weeks of trade, it's, you know, if you're an end user, I'd say you're not in a hurry to cover needs right now, the way it's looked. And Russia had a big crop, Canada year over year, big increase in production. France, I read the other day, was 98% good to excellent rating. I know ours going into dormancy is not in good shape. But if you throw all those things together, I'd say you can afford to be patient. But putting in new lows here recently, and I think depending on the contract, we're close to $2.50 or $2.60 off of the highs from the spring and early summer. That's a big move. That's a big chunk taken off value-wise of that market. So I think that would be something somebody could could be interested in the long side of that going into next year.
Yeah, Sue Martin said on the show recently, she said, if you've waited to sell now, why not keep waiting? Because you might get it to bounce back. You've missed your opportunity, the $2
right.
you're referencing there.
Right, right.
In corn, that is a fundamental story that circles around a global demand for the crop, and there's always the C word, the China, hanging out over our head. Were you surprised China has been buying so much U.S. corn?
I would say no, and they're pretty good about buying it at the right time. You know, I think you can say that with the soybean market as well. And I think you could probably look for that to continue. We've got, I'm sure they know the balance table's pretty tight too, and it won't take much of a hiccup in production for that to be exacerbated. So I think you could look for that to continue. And they haven't been, you know, with COVID and the way they've treated lockdowns, they haven't been exactly moving forward as they typically would economically. So I think you might see some pent up demand, whether it's corn or bean oil and meal. And that could spill over into the hog market as well.
Do you see an acreage fight that makes it pretty much 50-50 in the United States, corn, soybeans? Do you see the ratio changing in 23?
I would say it would favor the bean market right now, but that's going to depend on what happens in South America, obviously. Always a caveat, right? And that, I think, for the most part, you know, people have been looking for big numbers out of both Brazil and Argentina. Argentina's been on the dry side. I think Brazil generally has been pretty benign. But I would think price-wise going into next year, we're going to see a lot of producers looking at maybe planting more beans compared to corn.
Do you get in the camp like Matt Bennett does? American farmer sure likes to plant corn, and will plant it if there's even a slight chance that it's a better option for him.
Yeah, I think there's probably some truth to that.
Do you see price highs coming for the year in the first 6 months of 23 in corn?
I would say the way it looks to me, I would expect to see highs made in beans sooner than corn. And that's basically just the way it looks on a chart for the time being. Beans have really held their value. They're kind of pushing the upper end of the range. Meanwhile, corn's just kind of fallen out of the bottom side of the range. And obviously, corn's not getting any help from the wheat market. So,
yeah. You keep bringing beans into the conversation. I suppose we should talk about that a little bit. What is it you like about soybeans? You mentioned chart movement. Is that what gets you excited, or is there a fundamental side to beans that gets your attention?
Yeah, I'd say it's a little bit of both. And I'll admit to being more of a technician as opposed to a fundamental analyst. I do a fair amount of reading, but I try to kind of cap it because eventually it'll just cloud your judgment. So, you know, I think if you look at kind of some macro things, I would throw the crude oil market out there as one thing. We just put in a new low yesterday. I've got some customers that are they're grain and livestock producers. Some of them will step in on the long side of the crude and call it a hedge. Sometimes it is, sometimes it really isn't. But I had one customer yesterday say, why does the market keep putting in new lows? And I said, well, I think that's an indication that, you know, the politically and worldwide, people are a little bit fearful of how the early part of next year, first, second quarter, are going to play out. If you see more confidence in economies, both locally and globally, you're not going to see crude oil putting in new contract lows. So I think that should be that. That to me kind of throws up a red flag about how things are now, but also how they might be going forward.
So maybe the global story or the stories in the last 6 months, 3 to 6 months of a recession's coming, a downturn's coming, and the crude oil market not responding as such. Now that you're telling me, it sounds like that the market is telling us something. The crude oil market specifically is telling us that maybe there's not as much confidence about the economy real soon, real fast.
I would say that's a good way to put it. That's a good way to put it. And if if I had to choose corner beans for someone to be long, I think that's why beans look that much better. Corn is kind of mirroring the crude oil in the fact that at least in the recent weeks, it's moving lower, whereas the bean market is kind of inching higher. If the bean market is inching higher in the face of crude oil putting in new lows, that's a bullish sign for the bean market.
Yeah. All right. In the last couple of minutes here, let's get into some livestock talk. How much do you look at? What do you like about, we'll start with beef. You like live cattle or feeders as an investment if I'm not somebody in the feedlot necessarily?
Yeah, in cattle, the last cattle on feed was, we have a small herd. The talk is that production first and second quarter of next year is going to be lower, not drastically, but lower. And the way that market is traded, it just seems to always get bought on a dip. It seems to hold value. I've got cattle producers that are kind of fearful of what happens in the equity market and the talk of recession and the like. And you just never really see it play out in the price of cattle. Traditionally, you'd think there'd be a correlation, and there has been, between a weak equity market and people stepping away from high price beef. But I think what the consumer has told us over the past 6 to 12 months is that even if the equity market's poor, we're still going to eat well. And then they have not stepped away from high price beef. So I think that's encouraging if you're a cattle producer, and hopefully that'll continue to be the case.
Yeah, as you see the holdback, finally maybe some holdback in those feeder markets, where in those yards where you're like, okay, I think we can finally afford, as corn has dropped a little bit and some of the input sides. Hog market, you kind of mentioned a little bit about earlier in our conversation. Do you like mm-hmm. hogs in the first part of 23?
I do. I think right now, seasonally, we're getting to a point where we have typically a pretty good supply. If you look at the summer months, I think those have outperformed. They outperformed the October, they've outperformed the December contract, and right now they're outperforming the February. So I think that's encouraging. And that market, I can't really, I wouldn't be able to explain why. But that, under a handful of times, but over the past 6 to 9 months, has had some sharp sell-offs, $12, $14, $15 in a short amount of time. And you think, well, that's it. The worm has turned and we're headed lower. 2 weeks later, we're back to the same value or even greater. And that's happened again recently, with both the nearby and the deferred contracts. So I think that's a friendly indicator. And I mentioned China and how they haven't been your typical China with the way they've treated lockdowns. So if they get that figured out, I think that could be friendly for a lot of things.
All right, I guess I didn't prep you for this one, but if you had to pick one contract, one commodity that you like in the first 6 months of 2023, Mr. O'Leary, what would it be?
Long wheat. And I'm I'm not, you know, I'll put a customer into corn and beans four times faster than I will the wheat market. Not a lot of wheat grown in Iowa. I don't have a lot of wheat producing customers. But I think that, if you compare the way that looked in the spring to the way it looks right now, that's a pretty depressed market. But not a lot of reason to get excited about a depressed market. That's one way to look at it. But, you know, taking 250 or 260 off of that contract, I don't see wheat going down another $1, $1.50, $2. So I think that's, even from a short covering standpoint, that's got some potential pop to it, you might say.
Smells potential. I love it. Also love the way wheat smells in the morning too. Sean O'Leary from Des Moines, Iowa. I appreciate your time. Thank you so much. And
yeah, I appreciate it too.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul.
My thanks to Sean O'Leary for his time and commentary on how he sees markets moving in 2023, at least for the first few months. If you have any thoughts or feedback for the program, you can also send an email to markettomarket@iowapbs.org. I'm Paul Yeager. Thanks for watching, listening, or reading. We'll see you next time.